Good morning, everyone. I believe that last week we reached the end of Book 9, Canto 1, which describes Savitri beginning to debate with death. On page 580, in the middle of the page, death tells her, "Oh mortal, turn back to thy transient kind. Aspire not to accompany death to his home, as if thy breath could live where time must die." And he goes on telling her how useless it is for her to follow him. But she's not. She doesn't answer him. On page 581, line 565. Was it 365? "The woman answered not. Her high, nude soul, stripped of the girdle of mortality, against fixed destiny and the grooves of law, stood up in its sheer will, a primal force. Still, like a statue on its pedestal, lone in the silence and to vastness bared, against midnight's dumb abysses, piled in front, columned shaft of fire and light, she rose." Savitri is like a column of flame. When we read these lines last week, I thought of suggesting to you, if you can, to have a look at the paintings for these two cantos of Canto 9 and Canto 10 that are in the picture gallery. These are among the most powerful paintings that Hutter has ever made, according to me. So we can move on to the next canto of Book 9. This is called "The Journey in Eternal Night and the Voice of the Darkness." That's page 582. The canto begins on page 582. So the page number's on the next page. The beginning of the canto, "The Journey in Eternal Night." I can't see who is sitting up there at the back. You just turned round. Who would you like to read?
Yeah, me.
Behind you. Do you like to read?
Yes, she's ready.
She's ready? Yeah. Okay, come.
"The Journey in Eternal Night, the Voice of the Darkness."
Continue. Thank you. Let's have a look at these three, a few lines. It's as if everything's waiting on this dreadful edge of night. It seems as if the end of the world has come. It's just waiting to fall, to disintegrate into the eternal silence. Heaven is there, the higher world, but it leans down towards them like the brow of menace, a threatening forehead of some threatening being in this dim and voiceless hush. So this moment, it's as if one has reached a point where one can't think even anymore. Thoughts stand mute, silent, on despairing verge. There's an edge, a borderline, but it doesn't seem to lead to anywhere. This is a verge where the last depths plunge into nothingness, and the last dreams must end. So there, on this kind of borderline, these people paused. Satyavan, death, Savitri. It's as if the darkness is just waiting to swallow up Savitri, all of Savitri, including her soul. Will you read? I can't see very well who is there. The next one down. Yes, please. No, wait a moment. We read line 10, 11. Now let's read line 12. But still, it seems as if everything is threatening Savitri. But
its long nights of tempered strength, motionless, her flame bright spirit, mute, erect, burned like a torch fire from a window room, pointing against the darkness, somber breast. The woman first affronted the abyss, daring to journey through the eternal night, armed with light, to advance her foot to plumb into the great and hueless vacancy. Immortal, unapplied, her spirit test the danger of the ruthless, eyeless quest. Night against night's inky ground, they stop, molding mysterious motion on her human head, a swimming action and a drifting merge, like figures moving before eyelids closed. All as in dreams when sleeping, gliding on.
Thank you. So here there's a change, no? Satyavan has been leading and death behind him, and Savitri has been following behind death. But now when they come to this edge of apparent total disintegration and darkness, she's the first one to step forward. And they will follow her. She's not dark. Her spirit is visible like a flame. So she steps forward. The woman first affronted the abyss, that dark nothingness. She dares to journey through the eternal night. She's armored with light. She's protected by her own light. She advanced her foot to plunge into the dread and hueless vacancy. This was the painting we were just looking at, Savitri stepping forward. Immortal, unappalled, her spirit faced the danger of the ruthless, eyeless waste.
The image of the torchlight from a window room is quite evocative of a place, an actual place, where there's a light inside and is illuminating the darkness.
Right, yes. So they, because she moves on, they move on. Will you read next, please? You.
Sorry.
You'd
like him to read again. The rock gates, heavy walls were left behind, etched through passages of receding time, present and past into the timeless left, arrested upon deep adventures dream. The future ended, drawn into nothingness, amid flashing sets, the womb obscured. The fading vestibules of a tenebrous world received them, for they were seen to move and yet receive
glancing yet to pass, a dumb position, a dim picture bounce, not conscious forms, setting a real thing.
Let's pause there. It's as if they're floating through this darkness. Against night's inky ground, they stirred, they make a small movement, and they mould their mysterious motion on Savitri's road. They follow her path, what she does, where she goes. But it's something like in dreams, a swimming action and a drifting march, like figures moving before eyelids closed, as if your eyes are closed, but you can dimly see figures moving in front of you, all as in dreams when slipping, gliding on. It's a kind of dream movement. So they passed those threatening rock gates. Savitri has stepped forward. They're moving on beyond that.
A mystery of terror, boundless, gathering its manly strength, surrounded.
Sorry, just wait a moment. Where are we starting from now? A swimming motion? The rock gates' heavy walls were left behind. This is line 27. Who will read? Patricia? You read? What about you, Bhuvana? Will you read? Yes, please continue from there. Yes.
The rock gates' heavy walls were left behind. As if through passages of receding time, present and past into the timeless lap, arrested upon dim, adventurous dream, the future ended drowned in nothingness. Amid collapsing sheaves, they own obscure. The very vestibules of a tenuous force received them, where they seemed to move and yet be still, nowhere advancing a footpath, a dumb procession, a dim pictured bomb, non-conscious forms threading a real scene, and mystery of terror's boundlessness gathering its hungry strength. The huge, pitiless void surrounded slowly with its soundless depths and monstrous, cavernous, a shapeless throat devoured her in a shadowy, strangling mass, the fierce spiritual agony of a dream.
Thank you. It's as if she's being swallowed up by that darkness. Anybody would like to ask anything?
Yeah, I want to understand why this role reversal. First, death was leading, now
yes, why this change? It's because she's taken the lead. Before, she was just following Satyavan. But now, when it comes to going further on, she's taken the lead. It shows her strength and that she's not going to be intimidated by these threats of death. Tinaka?
The mystery of terror's boundless gathering its strength, its hungry strength, the huge pitiless void surrounded slowly with its soundless death, and monstrous, cavernous, a shapeless throat involved her into its shadowies, the fierce spiritual agony of a dream, a curtain of impenetrable dread. The darkness hung around her cage of sense as when the trees have turned to bothered shades and the last friendly glimmer fades away. Around the bullock in the forest tied by hunters closes in no empty night. The thought that strives in the world was here unmade. Its effort it renounced to live and know. Convinced at last that it had never been, it perished, all its dream of action done. This clotted cipher was its dark result. In the smothering stress of this stupendous knot, mind could not think, breath could not breathe, the soul could not remember or feel itself. It seemed a hollow gulf of sterile emptiness, the zero oblivious of the sum it closed, an abnegation of the Maker's joy, saved by no white repose, no depth of peace.
Thank you. There's this wonderful picture of the poor bullock. No? He's the bait for the hunters, and they just tie him there in the forest. And he knows very well that it's not an empty forest. It's full of terrible predators. All he can do is just to remain there and wait his fate. Well, it's a very powerful image of the atmosphere that death is creating around Savitri. And then this next sentence, starting on line 50, is very interesting. The thought that strives in the world was here unmade. It's unmade like a piece of knitting that you unravel. No? Whatever thought it was that has created the world. Now, in this realm where they are, in this state they are in, that is, it doesn't apply anymore. That thought gives up, it renounces its the possibility of living and knowing. It's become convinced that it had never been, it's never really existed. That thought perished. All its dream of action done, finished, and all that's left is this clotted cipher. Clotted is something thick. A cipher is a nothingness. Nothingness. It's a thick, dark, clinging, viscous nothingness. And the next line it says it's even smothering. You can't breathe in that nothingness. The smothering stress of that stupendous nothing. Mind could not think, breath could not breathe. The soul couldn't remember or feel itself. It, the soul, seemed like a hollow gulf, a deep place of emptiness, which has no chance of producing anything useful. A zero, oblivious, unaware of the sum that it contains. An abnegation of the Maker's joy. The thought that has created all this world is a thought of delight, a will of delight. But now it's as if in this situation they are in this atmosphere which the god of death has created around them, then even this joy of the Lord is not allowed to exist. And that emptiness doesn't bring any state of wide repose, no peaceful, fulfilling nirvana. On everything that here claims to be truth and God, and conscious self, and the revealing word, and the creative rapture of the mind, and love, and knowledge, and heart's delight, all the positive things in the universe, on all these things, there fell the immense refusal of the eternal. No, none of this really exists. Is there's a will and a consciousness which is saying no to everything that we would value. Truth, God, conscious self, a revealing word, the creative rapture of the mind, love, knowledge, the heart's delight. All of these are the things that we value and that make life worth living. But they are getting refused, the immense refusal of the eternal. No. He's doing some kind of psychological magic, yes, creating this atmosphere, spreading this conviction of worthlessness and nothingness and darkness, meaninglessness. His intention is to convince Savitri that she must return. There's no hope of winning back Satyavan, but I think she's proving a little bit more difficult to convince than he expected. She does not get extinguished. And that's the next line. Rani, would you like to read?
As disappears a golden lamp in gloom, born into distance from the eyes of Gaia, into the shadows vanished Gaia. There was no course, no path, no end or goal. Visions she moved amid insensible gulfs, or drove through some great black unknowing way, or whirled in a dumb eddy of reason assembled by the There was none with her in the dreadful vast. She saw no more the vague, tremendous star. Her eyes lost their luminous succulence. Yet not for this her spirit failed, but held more deeply than the bounded senses can, which grasp externally and find to lose its object love. So when on earth they did, she had felt him straying through the glades. The glades a scene in her, its clefts, her being's vistas, opening their secrets to his search and joy, because to jealous sweetness in her heart, whatever happy space her his cherished feet preferred, must be at once her soul embracing his body, passioning dumbly to his tread. But now a silent gulf between them came. Into abysmal loneliness she fell, even from herself cast out, from love remote. Long hours, since long it seems when sluggish time is measured by the throbs of the soul's pain, in an unreal darkness, empty and drear, traveling, treading on the corpse of life, lost in a blindness of extinguished souls. Solitary in the anguish of the void, she lived in spite of death, she conquered it still. In vain her puissant being was oppressed, her heavy, long monotony of pain, tardily of its fierce self-torture, tired.
Thank you. Much earlier in the poem, we've had a description of King Asvapati descending into the nether realms of darkness and having an experience like this, as if losing even the sense of his own existence. And he was able to continue existing in spite of that refusal and denial. And Savitri too can manage it. But apparently it must be some kind of experience which the soul may have when leaving the body or having left the body, a sense of denial that it has to overcome. So how does she overcome it? Helmut?
At first, a friend as if a memory came, the spirits, the memory that wished to be solved. It wandered like a last ray of the moon, revealing to the night the soul of the certain time in the dream, darkness of its black hoods jeweled with the mystic glow. Its dull sleep folds shrank back in the corridor of its sleep, as though they felt all life in pain and suffered from the pale approach of night. Felt a sail through a heavy somber, the splendor of some bright eternity threatened with this faint gleam of wandering truth, her empire of the everlasting one. Implacable, in her following strength and confident that she alone was true, she strove to start the prayer into this life. Aware of her own inherent immensity, she revealed her giant bed of nothingness, her mouth of darkness swallowing all that is. She saw in herself a tender sun. But still, the light prevailed, and still it grew. And suddenly, to her lost self alone, her lips refused the cold embrace of hate. Her heart beats triumph in the grasp of pain. Her soul persisted, claiming for its joy, the soul of the beloved now seen no more. Before her, in the stillness of the world, once more she heard the treading of the world. And out of the dense darkness, Saturn, her husband, grew into a luminous shape.
Thank you. So in some way she's able to conquer the darkness. So then death challenges her again. Mei Hong, will you read?
Then a sound peered through that dead monster realm, vast like the surge in a tired swimmer, clamoring a fatal iron hearted roar, death mission to the night, this metal core. This is my sad immensity. This is the home of everlasting night. This is the secret of nothingness enthroned, the bed of life's desires. Hast thou beheld life's transient heart, and known from what a dream thou art was made? In this sincerity of the nude emptiness, hopes thou still always to last and love. The woman answered not, her speech refused. The voice of night then knew, and death then thought, in a beginningless infinity. Through her soul's riches unconfined, she gazed. She saw the undying fountains of her life. She knew herself eternal, without birth, but still opposing her with the endless night. Death, the dialogue inflict on her eyes, the immortal calm of this tremendous age.
Thank you. So he's trying to convince her, no? This is my silent, dark immensity. This is the home of everlasting night. This is the secrecy of nothingness, entombing, providing a tomb for the vanity of life's desires. Have you seen your source? Have you seen where you've come from? I'm showing you where, what is your origin, your transient heart, your short-lived existence. Recognize the dream. Where has it come from? The dream that you are. You dream that you are Savitri and that you love. That's all nonsense. If you have a look around my world, he says, in this stark sincerity of nude emptiness, are you going to go on hoping always that you will live forever and love forever? Savitri doesn't answer him, but she resists him with her inner strength. Her spirit refused that voice of night that knew, that seems to know, and death that thought. She's aware, because of all the experiences that she's been through, we have passed, traveled with her through her yoga, in the whole of book 6, she's aware of her own beginningless infinity. And she can look through these endless spaces of her soul's existence. She can see and know the source, the undying fountains of her life. She knows that she is eternal without birth. So these threats of death can't shake or terrify or bother her at all. But he's not going to give up yet. Manoha?
I would also like to read
Oh, sorry, we've missed you, Naren. Yes, please, you read.
But still opposing her with endless night, death, the dire god, inflicted on lies the immortal calm of his tremendous gaze. Although thou hast survived the unborn void, which never shall forgive, while time endures, the primal violence that fashioned thought, forcing the immobile vast to suffer and live, this sorrow victory only last thou hast won, to live for a little without Satyavan. What shall the ancient goddess give to thee, who helps thy heart beat? Only she prolongs the nothing in creed, existence and delays, with labor of living thy eternal sleep. The fragile miracle of thinking clay, armed with illusions, walks the child of time. To fill the void around, he feels and dreads the void he came from and to which he goes. He magnifies his self and names it God. He calls the heavens to help his suffering hopes. He sees around him with longing heart the rare species more conscious than himself that have not even his privilege of mind. And empty of all but their unreal view, the people, and peoples them with bright and merciful powers. For the sea rolls around him and earth quakes beneath his steps, and fire is at his doors, and death crowds gain the woods of life. Moved by the presences with which he yearns, he offers his implacable shrines his soul, and clothes all with the beauty of his dreams. The gods who watch the earth with sleepless eyes and guide its giant stumblings through the void have given to man the burden of his mind. In his unwilling heart they have lit their fires and sown its incurable unrest. His mind is a hunter upon tracks unknown, amusing time with vain discovery. He deepens with thought the mystery of his fate and turns to song his laughter and his tears. His mortality vexing with the immortal's dreams, troubling his conscience with infinite breath. They give him hungers which no food can fill. He is the cattle of the shepherd gods, his body the tether with which he strives. They cast for fodder grief and hope and joy. His pasture ground they are fenced with ignorance. Into his fragile, undefended breast, they have breath a courage that is met by death. They have given a wisdom that is mocked by night. They have traced a journey that foresees no goal. Aimless man toils in an uncertain world, lulled by inconstant pauses of his pain, scourged like a beast by the infinite desire, bound to the chariot of the dreadful God.
Thank you. This is the message of death. This is what he tries to convince us all. And he mocks savagery. You have survived this emptiness, but what are you expecting from that ancient goddess who is helping and supporting you? She's just making your weary time last longer. This nothing which you dream to be an existence. And she's just delaying for a little while with the labor of living your eternal sleep. That's surely much more desirable than all this labor of living. And then he gives his description. It's quite a colorful description of our humanity. A fragile miracle of thinking clay, armed with illusions, walks the child of time. And to fill the emptiness around him, which he feels and he knows that's where he's going back to, he just blows himself up. And that magnified picture of himself, he calls it God. Man calls to the heavens to help his suffering hopes. He looks up to those heavens with a longing heart. But what are they? Just bare spaces. They don't even have as much consciousness as he has himself. They don't have even this privilege of mind, of consciousness, those heavens from which we hope so much. They are empty, totally empty of everything, but they are unreal blue, that blue illusion. So he peoples them with bright and merciful powers. He has to do that. It's a kind of protection or support. For the sea roars around him and earth quakes beneath his steps and fire is at his doors. There are times and places where it seems like that, no, that everything's in a stage of collapse. Death prowls, baying like a hound on the trail of its prey. Death prowls, baying through the woods of life. So we human beings, he yearns with these presences within him. So he offers his soul in implacable shrines, shrines which can never be satisfied. He tries to cover everything with the beauty of his dreams. The gods who watch the earth with sleepless eyes. So he does admit that there are gods like that watching. He says they watch the earth with sleepless eyes and guide its giant stumblings through the void, through the emptiness, have given to man the burden of his mind. It's a load, it's a difficulty. In his unwilling heart, those gods have lit their fires, and like a farmer sowing seeds, they have sown in the heart of man uncurable unrest. Man can never be satisfied either. So his mind is a hunter upon tracks unknown. It's always exploring, but it's just passing the time with useless discovery. With thought, he deepens the mystery, the insoluble mystery of his fate. He turns to song, his laughter and his tears. It's one of the resources of humanity, creativity. He just disturbs his mortal state, he who is in the grip of death and ignorance. He troubles that human state of his with the dreams of the immortals. His own transience he troubles with the breath of the infinite. This is because these gods have given to us human beings hungers which no food can fill. He says, you human beings, you're just the cattle of the gods. They will let you feed in their pastures for a while, and when they've finished with you, then they'll finish you. The body is the tether with which he's tied. They keep hold of each of us with this body. And what kind of food do they give us? Fodder is animal food. To feed us, they feed us with grief and hope and joy. Tether, it's the rope that you tie the animal with. You tether it to a post or somewhere. This pasture ground that they've created for him, it's all fenced around with ignorance. And into the fragile, undefended breast of the human being, those gods have breathed a courage that is met by death. They have given a wisdom that is mocked by night. They have traced a journey that foresees no goal. Man can't help being aimless, toiling endlessly in an uncertain world, lulled, pacified from time to time by inconstant pauses of his pain. There are times that are not so bad. Scourged like a beast by the infinite desire, bound to the chariot of the dreadful gods. This is the picture which death paints for us of our human existence.
This seems to be very true.
He's convincing, isn't he? He's quite convincing. Yeah. Except we have to remember that he's the great cheater, the great liar. No. Yeah.
gives us half-truths, always half-truths, so we tend to believe what he says.
Yes. And now he's going to offer her something. Who will be next then? Is it? Manoha?
But if thou still canst hope and still wouldst love, return to thy body's shell, thy tie to earth, and with thy hair's feeble remnants tightly, hope not to win back to thee such a one. Yet, since the strength deserves no trivial crown, give such a gift to soothe thy withered life. The pacts which transient being make with fate, and wayside sweetness earthbound hearts would pluck, these, if thy will accepts, make freely thine. Choose a life's hopes for thy deceiving friends.
He wants to satisfy her, send her back, and this is the first thing he offers to her, a life's hope. And he says, if that will satisfy you, but she doesn't accept it. No? Continue, please, Manoha.
As ceased the rapturous and tremendous voice, unendingly there rose in savagery, like moonlit ridges on a shuddering flood, a stream of thoughts out of some silence born, across the sea of a dumb, fathomless heart. At last she spoke, her voice was heard by night. I bow not to thee, O huge mask of death, black lie of night in the cowed soul of man, unreal, unescapable end of things. Thou grim jest played with the immortal spirit, conscious of immortality I walk, a victor spirit conscious of my force. Not as a suppliant to thy gates I came, unslain I have survived through the clutch of night. My first strong grief moves not my seated mind. My unwept tears have turned to pearls of strength. I have transformed my ill-shaped, brittle clay into the hardness of a statued soul. Now, in the wrestling of the splendid gods, my spirit shall be obstinate and strong against the vast refusal of the world. I stoop not with the subject mob of minds who run to glean with eager, satisfied hands and pick from its mire with many trampling feet its scornful, small concessions to the weak. Mine is the labor of the battling gods, imposing on the slow, reluctant ears, flaming will that reigns beyond the stars. They lay the law of mind on matter's world, and win the souls we wish from earth's inconscient force. First, I demand whatever Satyavan, my husband, waking in the forest charm, out of his long, pure childhood's lonely dreams, desired and had not for his beautiful life. Give, if thou must, or if thou canst refuse.
Yes, she said, I have not come as a suppliant. I haven't come asking anything from you. No. Give if you must. Eugen, would you like to read?
Death bowed his head in scornful, cold assent. The builder of this dreamlike earth for man, who has mocked with vanity all gifts he gave. Uplifting his disastrous voice, he spoke. Indulgence to the dreams my touch shall break. I yield to his blind father's longing heart. Kingdom and power and friends and greatness lost, and royal trappings for his peaceful age. The pallid pomps of man's declining days, the silvered, decadent glories of life's fall. To one who wiser grew by adverse fate, God, goods I restore the deluded soul prefers, to impersonal nothingness bear sublime. The sensuous solace of the light I gave, to eyes which could have found a larger realm, a deeper vision in their fathomless night. For that this man desired, and asked in vain, while still he lived on earth and cherished hope.
So he manages to spoil the gift while he's giving it. Yes, continue.
Back from the grandeur surrounds. Go, mortal, to thy small primitive sphere, hast and swift-footed, lest to slay thy life, the great laws thou hast violated move, open at last on thee their marble eyes.
So he's giving her something. He mocks what he's giving, saying it's anyway worthless. And then he says, well, now I've given you what you asked for. You have to go back. And Savitri's answer is so much greater than that. Paula? Wait a minute. Is it okay? Nowadays we're trying to record the questions and the readings as well.
But Savitri answered the disdainful shade, world spirit, I was thy equal spirit born. My will too is a law, my strength a god. I am immortal in my mortality. I tremble not before the immobile gaze of the unchanging marble hierarchies that look with the stone eyes of law and fate. My soul can meet them with its living fire. Out of thy shadow, give me back again into earth's flowering spaces, Satyava, in the sweet transiency of human limbs, to do with him my spirit's burning will. I will bear with him the ancient mother's load. I will follow with him earth's path that leads to God. Else shall the eternal spaces open to me, while round us strange horizons far recede, traveling together the immense unknown. For I, who have trod with him the tracts of time, can meet behind his steps whatever night or unimaginable stupendous dawn breaks on our spirits in the untrod beyond. Wherever thou leadest his soul, I shall pursue.
So beautiful. But he will not give up yet. Do you like to read?
But to her aim opposed, insisting on the immutable decree, and the insignificance of created things, out of the rolling winds of night there came, born from the enigma of the unnameable depths, a voice of majesty and appalling scorn, as when the storm herald Titan's striding sea throws on or swimmers its tremendous laugh, remembering all the joy its waves have drowned. So from the darkness of the sovereign night, against the woman's boundless heart arose the almighty cry of universal death. Hast thou got wings or feet that tread my stars, frail creature who is the goddess that aspires, forgetting thy bounds of thought, thy mortal role, their orbs were coiled before thy soul was formed. I, death, created them out of my void. All things I have in them, and I destroyed. I made the world my net, each joy I missed. A hunger, amorous of its suffering prey, life that devours. My image see in things mortal. Spirit is my wandering breath, whose transience was imagined by my smile. Flee, clutching thy poor gaze to thy trembling breast. Pierced by my pangs, time shall not soon appease. Blind slave of my death force, whom I compel to sin that I may punish, to desire that I may scourge thee with despair and grief, art thou come bleeding to me at the last. Thy nothingness recognized, my greatness known. Turn not attend, forbidden, happy friends, meant for the fools that can obey my law. Let in their somber shrines thy dread awake. From their uneasy, iron-hearted sleep, the bodies who avenge fulfilled desire, dread that in the skies where passion hopes to live. The unknown lightnings start and terrified, lone, sobbing, haunted by the hounds of heaven. A wounded and forsaken soul, thou flee through the long torture of the centuries. Nor many lives exist, the tireless wrath hell cannot slake, nor heaven's mercy assure. I will take from thee the black eternal grief, clasping the heart, thy fate's exiguous dole. Depart in peace, if peace for man is just.
In this version here, we've got a spelling mistake. Exiguous, clasping in thy heart thy fate's exiguous dolls. Exiguous means almost worthless. Is it clear, all this? Anybody would like to ask anything? Immitigable, yes. Something which is immitigable, it can't be mitigated, it can't be made less.
I think these next lines are among the most powerful in the whole book.
Where Savitri answers him. But perhaps we'll leave them for next week.
What is your slake?
To slake, you need to slake your thirst. You're so thirsty, you have to drink some water or something to slake it. I think also it's something you have to do with lime, isn't it? If you want to make lime usable for construction, you have to pour water on it.
If the thirst of that lime is drenched, it finished. Mm. If you pour water, it doesn't absorb more water. So the thirst of the lime is over. The slake lime we have.
What is exiguous?
Exiguous, something that's too small, very small, almost worthless. So he says, I'm giving you something. The gods will give you something, but it's not worth having.
A dole
is like a dole. A dole is, if you don't have any work, if you go to the labor exchange and wait there long enough, they may give you enough to feed you for that one day. A dole, something that's doled out, given. You. It's also normally exiguous, it's not much.
Again, I'm wondering why is he, his own gifts he's undervaluing. Why would he do that?
He wants to make her hopeless. He's trying to make her give up. No? He won't succeed, but that seems to be what he's doing. And he's wanting to give to us a kind of hope, paint for us a kind of hopeless picture.
He's still feeling that he's strong and fair. Or make
him do that. Why does he speak about the hounds of heaven?
The hounds of heaven, it's a kind of well-known phrase. And hounds are hunting dogs. Yeah. So there's a famous poem from the 19th century, The Hound of Heaven, which describes how the Lord will pursue you until you give up and recognize that he's the Lord, actually. It's the idea of a hunting dog chasing you. So in this case, it's threatening. Here it's threatening.
The association is strange hounds and heaven.
Mm. Mm. Sorry?
The association of hounds.
Hounds and heaven, yes. I think Sri Aurobindo's taking advantage of that rather well-known poem, The Hound of Heaven, where there the hound is Christ, is Jesus. Oh, and finally, the one who's chased has to admit that the Lord has found him and given him everything he wants.
I think there's reference to it also in the Vedas.
Mm-hmm. The hounds of heaven? Yes, very likely, no? There's of course Sarama.
Yeah.
So she's a hound in the sense that she can sniff things out. She will find things that are hidden.
I have a suggestion. When we make a question, could you say the line? Because we use in words, but we don't go into the meaning.
Can we register that? If you have a question, then you should mention which line you are asking about. Yes, so that means taking a bit of time when you've put your hand up and they're ready to listen to your question. Then you would say, this is referring to line so and so, this word. Yeah, we can try this discipline.
Yes, okay, this line 355, I don't get this image of hounds of heaven. Still that, you refer to that poem, but still that image is not clear.
Well, it's the idea of the hound is hunting.
Yes.
He's chasing you. And here it is very threatening that what you are doing, Savitri, is you are flouting the divine laws. And if you had better stop that immediately. Otherwise, these hounds of heaven, these furies, these punishing deities are going to come and punish you for being demanding. And,
So there are hounds in the heaven also to punish gods.
Yes.
Is it that way?
I think there may be different nuances to the meaning of a hunting dog, no?
Yeah, this is what I wanted to say, the same thing. Heaven is supposed to be compassionate.
So why are we afraid? No, but of course sometimes we are, and sometimes, as with here, we are threatened. No, and that the furies will come and punish you for your disobedience and your demands.
The sun is supposed to be, but as we know, the asura is also Brahma.
Well, it depends what role he's playing in the play, you know, at the time.
But it's a fear. A fear-based point of view. That's what I understand.
Yeah, maybe it's a Christian idea.
Yeah, I should try and bring you the text of this beautiful poem.
They are descending from heaven and they're punishing.
Well, that's what he's suggesting here. In the poem, in the Christian poem, it's not like that. It's that the Lord will be always following you until you surrender to him. And then as soon as you do that, you will wonder why you ever resisted him. Shall we leave it there for today? Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.